Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bonnie Sutterth. I'm Leanne Dofano. And I don't know if anybody has told you, but Thomas Michelle is delayed in traffic, has called in, has been on his way for a while, and has every intention of being here. So that's the second case, and I understand everybody in the first case is ready to go. All right, then if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
May it please the court, counsel for Appalee. My name is Davis McCown. I represent Jeremy Sanders. Mr. Sanders was the defendant below and is the appellant in this court. This case involves basically interpretation of an employment contract and what constitutes parts of the contract and what might not constitute parts of the contract. Specifically, it involves whether some documents sent with the contract were actually intended by the parties and legally become a part of the employment contract. By way of a little background, the defendant is a network security engineer, which means he installs network and security devices and software on companies' computers for any kind of company that has several computers that are linked together. There's no niche market. They do this for all companies all around this area. The plaintiff, FutureCom, provides network and security products for their clients. Again, this is various types of businesses. The company is what is known as a value-added seller or reseller, which is important to some of the later facts. The bottom line is they don't manufacture any software or create any software, and they don't manufacture any hardware. What they do is they buy it from other companies, and then they install it, train the people on how to use it, make sure that it's working, maintain it, things of this nature. And these other vendors become important to the facts later. The defendant applied for a job with FutureCom in March of 2010. He was sent an email with five documents. The most important were a two-page offer letter saying that, you know, you've been offered a job or you're being offered a job with us at a certain salary, and a nine-page employment agreement. There were some other documents which really aren't relevant to the lawsuit, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. They are discussed, I believe, in the brief. The offer letter offered him a starting salary of $56,000. The offer letter also contained a paragraph which says, and this is basically the gist of the lawsuit, any training provided to you by FutureCom, included but not limited to, salary paid for study or course time, cost of material, classes, and travel expenses, will be your responsibility to repay FutureCom should you voluntarily leave or be dismissed for a gross company violation within 1 year of completing the course. So this, or completing the training. This created an ongoing obligation as long as he worked at the company that any time he left, if this is part of the contract, he has to go back and pay for his last year's worth of employment expenses. The employment agreement also had two non-compete provisions in it, which aren't is critical to this particular issue. He executed and returned these documents by email on March 22nd, 2010. He started working for the company. And immediately he was trained. They were sent off to the various vendors that provide the software, the different components, the programs, the hardware, and they would teach him how to use their products so that he could go out to FutureCom's companies and install the products. And when he did, he would earn certificates indicating that he was competent in the installation and maintenance of this equipment and this software. And when he got these certificates, these were beneficial to the company, because then the company would get discounts when they ordered these products for their customers, and they would get referrals because these vendors would know, okay, FutureCom has a guy that can install this stuff, so we'll send this call or this inquiry about our products to FutureCom. So it generated income for them when he received this training. Over the course of the 3 years, he received three raises and was earning over $100,000, a little over $100,000 when he left. In April of 2010, he did get another job opportunity. He provided the notice that he was leaving and asked to leave. In May of 2013, a couple of days after he left, he was sent an invoice for $38,000 for the training costs for his past year. And then he was sued for breach of the covenants not to compete and disclosure of confidential information and related causes of action. And then later, the lawsuit was amended to allege that he hadn't paid the invoice that they sent him. That was in their third petition. The trial court entered judgment for $38,480, which is the amount of this unpaid training cost. The trial court did not enter any judgment on the covenants not to compete, did not find any monetary losses on the non-disclosures, basically didn't find that he did anything wrong other than not paying for this training for the past year, based on this clause in this letter. And it's the first point of argument then that the trial court erred as a matter of law in finding this offer letter, which was sent with this agreement, was part of the agreement between the parties. And basically, as a matter of law, the agreement was not part of the agreement. There isn't any one factor or circumstance that we look to and say this conclusively proves that it's not part of the agreement, but more the totality of the circumstances. There was a federal judge in Dallas that ruled in the DT Apartment Group case, which is in the brief, and the way he phrased it, he says you look at the most natural reading of all the documents. And we believe that looking at the most natural reading of the documents indicates that this offer letter is not part of the contract and was not designed by anybody to be contractual. The totality of the circumstances are important. The appearance and nature of the documents is one thing to look at. You have a 9-page formal agreement, which is signed by the CEO of the company, outlining his terms and conditions of employment, and then you have a 2-page offer letter, which is generated by the manager of human resources, who there was no evidence whatsoever that she had any authority to even enter into contractual provisions for the company, or that she even was the one that actually generated it, although it was in her name. And it's not even signed. It's just, here's what you're going to get for working for us, here's what we expect you to do, and here's a couple other little provisions. So the offer letter is set out as a letter basically advising him of what life at their company is going to be like, what kind of benefits he can expect, and what they expect of him as far as job duties. The employment contract, on the other hand, is very clear that it's designed to be a comprehensive employment contract. The very first paragraph says the purpose of this agreement is to outline the terms of the employment of the associate. The most important paragraph is paragraph 44, which is a merger and integration clause. And a merger and integration clause, as the cases discussed in the brief, simply says that this agreement is the entire agreement between the parties. If we had any other agreement, it's void and superseded by this agreement because we're putting it all down in one document so there's no confusion later as to what the terms are. And it has a very clear, unambiguous merger clause that says all previous agreements, either oral or written, are expressly superseded and revoked by this agreement. So even if the offer letter constituted an agreement at some point, the employment agreement overrides it. Secondly, though, at paragraph 45, right below that, it contains an amendment clause. So even if you say, well, the offer letter was signed after the contract, because we don't know what order the documents were signed in, if that's going to be important, it has an amendments clause which says this agreement cannot be modified unless the modifications are in writing and signed by the CEO and specifically reference this employment agreement. So either way you look at it, the employment agreement is very clear that it wants to be the only legal document covering the terms of his employment, and no other documents are going to be applicable. And the offer letter does contain additional terms about his employment, but there's no indication that these terms are designed to be contractual. For instance, it lays out some of his benefits, discussing vacation and investments and bonuses and things of this nature. But there's no testimony, there's no documents, there's no indication that the company wanted to be contractually bound by these provisions.
Well, if it's not contractual, what is it?
It's just a benefit that they're giving their employees that they can take away. If it's not in the contract, they're just saying it's like a policy of the company. Our policy is that we will provide these bonus programs during the year, things of that nature. And then if the company says, look, we can't afford this bonus program anymore, or we're going to change it to some other bonus program, they have the flexibility to do that without going back and amending the contracts of all the employees. One particular one is the salary, because his salary is in the offer agreement. Well, if his salary is contractual, as they say it would be because it's in the offer agreement, that means it has to be amended according to the terms of the employment agreement by a written document signed by the CEO. And the evidence is it was amended 3 times without any change in or amendment to the contract whatsoever. They just came in and said, we're raising your salary, clearly indicating that they weren't following the contract. The same with his job duties. They were changed just by saying, we're changing your job duties, even though his job duties.
It's your position then, because I noticed in your brief, it's your position then that this requirement is, there's nothing the matter with this requirement other than that it wasn't included in the contract.
Well, yes, that it's not part of the contract, so it's not contractual. That it was just an advisory thing that somebody, we don't even know who put that in the letter, who authorized it. It was not ever discussed by the parties. It just shows up in a letter saying you've got a job.
Well, I noticed that in your brief you're saying that it's unconscionable, restraint of trade, violation of public policy.
Basically, those are alternate arguments, that if you do find it is part of the agreement, then in the alternative, that it's unconscionable and restraint of trade. Those are basically secondary arguments. Okay. Our main argument is it's not part of the contract and never was intended to be. And even if it was intended by someone to be, like the human relations manager, it was overwritten by the merger clause, which is what the CEO signed and what Mr. Sanders signed. And he did sign the letter, but that's just an acknowledgement. Yeah, I've got this, I've seen it, I'm signing it and I'm returning it. It's also important then to look at the contract and see that it covers training. Most importantly, at paragraph 16 of the contract, it says the company will instruct and train the associate and provide access to all relevant and necessary business information that may be needed by the associate to perform his or her duties as an associate of the company. So the employment contract has a provision obligating the company, an unequivocal provision obligating the company, to train Mr. Sanders. And then this obligation is repeated at paragraph 17, paragraph 21, and paragraph 22, using different language. Some of the language specifically saying this is part of the consideration for your coming to work for us, is we're going to train you in how to do your job. And now this is where it gets important, because that they don't make or sell their own products, because it says some of the language, not all of it's relying on this, but some of it says this is going to be involving the company's systems, the company's software, the company's hardware, but the company doesn't make any of that stuff. They resell other people's. So the only logical interpretation is when they're saying that, they're talking about the products of their vendors, which is what Mr. Sanders is being charged for learning about. And the offer letter specifically says it applies to any training. So this sort of shows two things. One, it shows that the training was covered by the employment agreement, so it wasn't intended to be covered by the offer letter. But it also shows, too, which is the second point of error, it creates an ambiguity. If you say, okay, the offer letter is part of the contract, and the employment contract says the company has an unequivocal obligation to provide training, and the offer letter says, no, you've got to repay for it, it's not part of the consideration, that creates an ambiguity which makes it unenforceable in any extent. So that's our second ground of error. It kind of ties in with the first ground, that the it wasn't intended to be part of the contract, but even if you try to read it in, it becomes ambiguous and unenforceable as a matter of law. The third and fourth points of error do raise the issue that it's unconscionable and unenforceable as a matter of public law. And again, this is in the alternative. If you do say, yes, we believe this was a contract, which it's our position adamantly that it wasn't, or that it wasn't part of the contract. And it's also important to remember that it wasn't alleged by the plaintiff to be part of the contract. If you look at their petition, it says Mr. Sanders entered into an employment agreement with FutureCom, a true and correct copy of which is attached as Exhibit A of this petition. Then if you go look at Exhibit A of the petition, it has the 9-page employment agreement, but it doesn't have the offer letter. The offer letter wasn't even included in the first petition because, according to them, he hadn't violated it yet because the invoice was still had days before he could pay it. But even when they went back and refiled and sued him for not paying for the training expenses, they said that this was under a contract with the company, and they said that that was attached as Exhibit C. They never, in the petition, anywhere say, this offer letter is part of this contract and it's all one thing. This didn't come up until Mr. Sanders filed a motion for summary judgment, saying, look, Judge, if this is a separate contract, then we deserve to have it voided because the employment agreement has a merger clause.
Excuse me. Let me make sure I understand this because I'm easily confused. Part of the obligations of his employment, part of the obligation was that he be trained. Part of his job was to be trained to to do the job.
Yes, ma'am.
He received a salary for the time he was doing what he was obligated to do as an employee, which
yes,
was
ma'am.
To be trained. There was no additional expense to the company for his training other than salary, or there was additional expense?
And the invoice is divided out. Basically, $34,000 of the invoice is returned salary for that time. They say, during this time period, you were being trained. We want that salary back. There's about $4,000 or so that adds up to the total $38,000, where they say, this is money we spent to send you off somewhere, you know, an airplane or whatever, cab fares, expenses for training and paying for a seminar. Usually the seminars were free because the vendors wanted the training. But anyway, yeah, so it breaks down to $34,000 is return salary and $4,000 and some change.
Did he have the option of not attending the training?
They said that he, it's in the brief that he, I don't remember exactly how it's worded, but basically my opinion is no. That if he stopped training, he wouldn't have a job. They said he would have a decision to make, and I asked them, the decision would be whether he works here or not, and they said yeah.
So he was required as part of his job to participate in this training. He received a salary for doing what was part of his job description?
Yes, ma'am.
And now they want the salary back?
Yes, ma'am.
Just want to make sure I understood it.
That's okay. Exactly right.
Any other questions? Okay. No, it's okay, Davis. Okay, Laura.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to first begin by further addressing the question that you just raised, if I may, briefly.
Thank you.
There are two different types of training. We have sort of a general training that's the support for the non-compete agreements. That's exposure to pricing lists, customers, customer needs, FutureCom's internal processes and procedures, the kind of things that you would normally see in an agreement that is set to provide compensation or consideration, rather, for non-compete agreements. What we're talking about here is a different kind of training. This is vendor specific. This is training to become certified in different vendors' products. A couple of examples you may or may not be familiar with: McAfee, that's an antivirus kind of a software suite. Infoblox is another example you'll see mentioned throughout the brief. And Blue Knight and Blue Coat, these are some of the specific vendors that provided software services that my client then resold, and that's the nature of their business, to different customers. So we're talking about two different things. And we unequivocally say, and the client has said, and the plaintiff throughout, that is not training that was required. That was an opportunity that was afforded to Mr. Sanders. And in fact, specifically, if you'll look in the record, you'll see that in his correspondence back to the HR representative that presented him the offer for the job initially, he said, quote, that he knows that there is a great opportunity there for training and the technical experience, and this is all new, and this is a great position for someone that is interested in change and learning. So he's acknowledging there that this is an opportunity unique to this position that comes along with this position for him to gain leaps and bounds, things that he will then take with him should he leave. Of course, nobody...
Sort of like the lawyers who come to this court.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We should ask for their salary back when they leave?
No, this is something different. Let's say, for example, akin to providing someone going to get training to become a mediator or some specific subset that's not part of what's required of their job. Mr. Sanders could do his job without obtaining these mastery level certifications. In fact, there's testimony throughout in the record supports that Chris Boykin, his supervisor, would seek out individuals and say, okay, who wants to get certified in this, or who wants to obtain mastery level in that? And someone would say, oh, yeah, I'd be interested in that, or I'd rather wait. I'm interested, but it's a big time commitment. I want to do that later. So it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity that FutureCom provided because it would reap benefit from it in some degree. And the degree that it reaps those benefits, it quantifies as a year's worth of time from the completion of the training. And so when that certification walks out the door with that employee takes those benefits with them, the same benefits that you heard Mr. McCown discussing, the discounts. You know, when my client gets software at a discount and then can reap that additional profit when they resell it, that's a benefit to them. Furthermore, this idea that you get the referrals from the vendors, this is a client who's interested in these services or these higher levels of technical service, it provides benefit to my client to do that. And if there were no benefit to them and there were no expense to them, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But they can't be expected to expend all of the cost, including the time that it takes him to do these certifications, without getting any of the benefit back. And that's the crux of the issue before you today is it truly unreasonable or unconscionable or against public policy for my client to seek some reimbursement for what is expended to train Mr. Sanders in these particular areas, which he then takes with him? Returning back to the first point of error and with regard to whether the...
In other words, what you're saying is that your client shouldn't bear the burden of paying for the employee to get trained for a new job.
Exactly, Your Honor, yes. Because in contrast to that, this competitor, which he did go then work for the specific competitor of FutureCom, doesn't have to pay that. They have the benefit of, hey, we can pay you a higher salary, come work over here, because they can offset that higher salary with a lack of expense in having to train him, because he's got all that with him. Not only the training that...
And they were out of pocket to send him to that training.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Furthermore, he was with FutureCom for 3 years, had none of this training when he first arrived. For the first at least 6 months of his time there, FutureCom wasn't able to bill out, which is part of how they get money from their clients, any of his time, because it was all spent on training. And so, again, we're not going back to day one here. We're just saying the last 12 months, which that's what he agreed to at the beginning. That's what they determined, and they all agreed was a reasonable amount of time. But for that period of time, and any period of time that he's seeking training, he's not then doing things that are billable to a client, much like an attorney that does work that is billable. So that's the way that we believe that it's not unconscionable or against public policy for them to seek not only the travel and actual cost of the seminars and things, but also the time that he spent doing that they couldn't then recoup from a client. We feel like there's not a whole lot of question on whether or not this was part of an agreement. The DT apartment case that was cited, that deals with a set of loan documents, and in that case, the court found that an application was not considered part of the loan documents. That was something that was signed months before the loan documents were. It would be akin to us, I guess, trying to say that his resume or his application for employment through Monster or something like that was part of his employment agreement, which we're not doing here. Also, distinguishing that case from the case at Bar, in this case, all of our documents were sent to him at one time. He had 4 days. He had as much time as he wanted to, but he took 4 days to read them and return them all together, all signed. He had previously made attempts to negotiate and indicated a lack or no lack of ability or willingness to try to negotiate the terms of salary. We don't believe there's any reason that he felt, you know, compelled to accept this. He didn't cross through anything. There's nothing in that offer letter that indicates, oh, by signing here, all you're signing is that you've seen it, which is what he is trying to say. That's all that he meant. And if it was all he meant, he should have X'd through the training and initialed it. And anything he wasn't agreeing to there, he could have X'd out. They also make much of that it was somehow hidden or not conspicuously labeled. That language is immediately above the section of that document where it says accepted and has a blank for his signature and his signature. And he did, in fact, return all of those documents together. And he has, I think, averred in his brief as well as his reply that doing those things can definitely be demonstrative of intent and the intent of the parties. With regard to my client allegedly not pleading that all the documents were part of it, that has been part of our pleading throughout. The document, the 9-page document, has a title. It says Employment Agreement with a capital E and a capital A. That is why that is oftentimes referred to as the Employment Agreement. It is not meant to single that out as the only part of the overall agreement between the parties. But that's why that's specifically called out and referenced in that way with regard to specific exhibits. And the plaintiff specifically stated unequivocally in his testimony that with regard to any kind of discovery answer or any way that they may try to use semantics to say that we somehow didn't intend for that to be part of the agreement, that it was always the intent that all 5 of those documents, which consists of their package to a prospective employer, are part of the agreement. That's why they have different terms in part of the documents. Nothing conflicts. It's all meant to be read together. The cases, I think, are clear. Fort Worth ISD, Jim Walter, El Paso, it's well established that you can look at multiple documents to comprise a single agreement between parties. And in fact, to ignore any one particular document, especially when it's all in the same transaction, dealing with the same thing, has the effect of voiding, and can have the effect of voiding, as it would here, a very important part of the agreement between the parties. It's our understanding that it was all fine and good. He accepted it. He was interested in it. He was appreciative of the opportunity. But then when an offer came along for him to go somewhere else and make more money, albeit with a direct competitor, suddenly he wasn't interested in holding up his end of the bargain.
What about the merger clause?
We don't believe the merger clause is relevant to the extent that the documents are all considered part of one agreement. In other words, there isn't a previous agreement, nor is there a subsequent agreement, because they all are part of one agreement. But to the extent that there's to be any kind of application of the merger clause, because the terms don't conflict with each other, they're not incompatible, there is no problem with the documents merging together. There's nothing to replace one from another. But that's sort of an alternative argument for us as well, because we don't believe that either a merger clause or an integration clause or an amendment clause has any applicability here, because they were all part of the same agreement. Now, if we're talking about we all enter into an agreement months down the road and that changes things, that would be considered a subsequent agreement. Or had we had something ahead of us that came before all of this stuff, then the order of the documents being signed and merger and integration and those things would come into play. But here we don't believe that's relevant, because all of it is part of a single employment agreement, and the agreement that accurately reflects what the parties intended at the time that it was executed. I want to touch briefly on the issue of unconscionability. To the extent the court's interested in that, that's a very, very difficult burden to be reached. And the cases that he cites in support of that, we have situations where a child that is later determined not to be the biological son of a father is sought to be written out of a partnership agreement because there was unilateral mistake, and to allow that child to continue to be part of that partnership agreement would be shockingly offensive. That's a very different situation than what we have from the case at bar, and unconscionability is very difficult to achieve, and we don't think that they've established that here, even if the court were to entertain that as an alternative grounds or defense there. With regard to looking at both so an unconscionability argument is to be examined from a procedural as well as a substantive stance. Procedurally, we would point out, again, the external circumstances and the atmosphere of the parties. You have documents sent to Mr. Sanders for him to review at his leisure. There's not a deadline for him to accept it. He has an opportunity to ask questions. He has an opportunity to renegotiate, to cross out items. He didn't do any of that. There's not a lack of bargaining ability of one party or the other. It's not unreasonable or oppressive for the same reasons I cited with regard to it's the Wernicke case that talks about the child being written out of the partnership. The language was there for me to read, but I shouldn't be held accountable for it because it wasn't conspicuous. It wasn't specifically called out. It's important to note, we're talking about 19 pages. All told, this isn't some big rambling document that's very difficult to maneuver or negotiate. And furthermore, he had the opportunity, the amount of time that he needed, never sought additional time or any kind of additional clarification for any of the terms. There's some discussion, I don't think it's been had yet, but with regard to the permanent injunction that was entered by the court, as was stated earlier, this case started with a temporary restraining order that was granted. That order was never dissolved. It converted into a temporary injunction. That injunction was likewise not resolved, but ultimately converted into a permanent injunction. The only portion of that was the non-disclosure. The courts allow a higher standard for the protection of confidential documentation. We're not talking about an injunction that goes on and prohibits him from soliciting customers or from competing. This is limited to the non-disclosure portion of it. And the only reason that we didn't seek additional time on the non-compete elements was that by the time we got to trial, those had run its course. That kind of dovetails into their argument with regard to their attorney's fees that they feel they're entitled to, which they're only entitled to if it can be demonstrated that the party sought to enforce an agreement that was unreasonably broad and that it knew it at the time that it was being entered into that was overly broad. And I think, again, we only sought to enforce what was in the agreement. The fact that it was somewhat reformed by the court as we went along through the process does not invalidate the agreement. It's a reformation. It does not entitle him to attorney's fees just because the document was reformed. It doesn't demonstrate that the client knew at the time that the covenants were being entered into, that they were unreasonable or overbroad, and nor did the client, or excuse me, the plaintiff ever seek to enforce them to an extent that was broader than necessary to preserve the goodwill of the business goodwill and the needs of his business. And so we likewise don't feel like the court erred in that regard. The permanent injunction does deal specifically with the confidential information of FutureCom. That's all that is being sought from this time forward. That's the only basis for that permanent injunction. There was nothing additional to that. The breach of contract deals with his agreement to make this repayment. These, importantly, another thing to consider, which is in the brief as well as the record, is that Mr. Sanders self-reported the time that he spent during the day with FutureCom. So this is not an arbitrary calculation. This is directly pulled from what Mr. Sanders reported as the time that he spent in studying and training and attending these conferences and obtaining these certifications that FutureCom now seeks its partial reimbursement for. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any questions? Thanks. Davis?
The appellee makes the argument that there's two different types of training, that there's training on the company's business and, you know, where you're supposed to park and how you get your payroll check and various things that are company policies, and that there's training on the vendor's equipment and devices and how you actually go and do your job. And that's how they distinguish the offer letter from the training in the contract. The problem is that theory or hypothesis doesn't match any of the language of the documents. The easiest one to look at is the offer letter. And what the offer letter says is that any training provided to you by FutureCom, included but not limited to salary paid for study or course, cost of materials, classes, travel time, will be a responsibility to repay. It doesn't say.
But the bottom line is they're not seeking reimbursement for training on company policies and all of that. They're only seeking reimbursement for training that Mr. Sanders self-reported.
Right. But what they're saying is that all those different provisions in the employment contract only applied to those company trainings and didn't apply to the vendor training at all. And what I'm saying is the documents don't support that reading. If they apply to the same training, that's when you have the ambiguity. In other words, they're trying to resolve the ambiguity by saying the offer letter is vendor training on the devices and the software we install. And all the discussion in those four paragraphs in the employment contract about training, that's all just company policies and company procedures and doesn't involve any vendor training at all. If that involves the vendor training, then you have a conflict between the two documents. But the two documents don't support that reading, and that's one of the reasons why it's important to remember, too, that the services that they provide, it says they'll provide all the training needed to do his job. Well, that's the vendor training, because he has to know how to install this equipment to go out and do his job, and that's what the employment agreement, I mean, it's paraphrasing, but that's what it's, you know, we believe it says. So there isn't two types of training. There's just training, and then there's a conflict between the documents. They said that that he walked out the door with those benefits, but he provided them 3 years of good service. I mean, there are frequently contracts that say if you leave in the first year or if you leave before repaying for a specific course, there's a lot of the ones in the brief that the plaintiff, that the appellee here cites, that talked about where people got specific training in a specific course, like how to be a paramedic or how to be an electrician, and they had to repay for that specific course they took before they left. Or there, I've seen contracts where you have to repay your moving expenses if you don't stay for a year. But he stayed for 3 years and provided services. And they said the thing is that when he left, they didn't get anything for their training. The problem is there's no evidence to support that whatsoever, because some of this training he received a year before he left. It could well be that during that year period that he did things and they got discounts and they got referrals that amounted to more than what they're charging them for. And I specifically asked the witness, did you receive benefit of his training during that year? And they said yes. But they didn't offer any amount. It's kind of like lost profits, to come in and say we lost all these profits, but not to include the costs that they avoided when they lost profits. Well, they say we lost all of this benefit of this training, but they don't say what he got for that year that he was getting the training, and they were getting the discounts and they were getting the services. Clearly, if he got trained a week before he left, maybe there'd been no benefit. But they didn't even try. There was no attempt made. But they keep saying that. They keep saying, we got no benefit from his training, but there's no evidence to support it. They say that he could have X'd out the clauses in the offer letter and that he should have known not to rely on them. But the point is, if he didn't consider that part of the contract, why X it out? Why go to the trouble to say, I'm not agreeing to this, when you've got a 9-page contract over here that doesn't have that term in it?
But doesn't that letter have the salary amount in it? He agreed to that.
He agreed to that, but that wasn't contractual. He knew that they could raise it or lower it. Their witness testified at trial they could raise or lower the salary as necessary. So he's acknowledging, yeah, I'm starting at $56,000. That's what you're telling me you're going to pay me. But if he went in, then, you know, and they did. They went in and said, okay, you're doing a good job. We're going to another rate. And they didn't go back and amend the contract in any form.
Does your client agree they could have reduced the amount of salary?
I think so, yes. I mean, I never asked him that, but I would.
I mean, so it's your position that that was just, salary figure was meaningless?
Well, it's advisory. They're just saying, this is what we intend to pay you. I mean, if they're in good faith, they're not going to reduce it immediately. I don't think they would reduce it unless he did something wrong.
Well, isn't salary a material term? I mean, how can you have an employment agreement if you don't have a salary?
The employment agreement has a salary section, and the salary section basically says the company will pay you a reasonable rate. I believe that's quoted in the first brief I filed. But, yeah, they say in the employment agreement, we'll pay you a fair and reasonable amount.
You're saying that he had an employment agreement with no salary?
Yes. And we'd like to submit all the other issues on the brief then.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming in. Your argument's been very helpful. Your case is submitted.